If I asked you who the most extraordinary person you've ever heard of was, who would you say? Now, of course, we have to be very careful with the words that we use in terms of describing this person. Extraordinary, awesome, amazing, incredible. Because when we start to ask questions like that, we get confused often. And this is understandable. I mean, some people will say that their grandfather or father or one of their uncles, someone who just they thought was amazing. And then some people will talk about some famous historical figure like Napoleon, Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Winston Churchill. And it reminded me of what Dan Carlin said when he was discussing Julius Caesar. He said Julius Caesar was awesome, but awesome doesn't mean good. And this is where I think we need to differentiate good from awesome or incredible or extraordinary. We're not talking about, this is not a discussion about morality. So when people think of, you know, the most amazing, extraordinary person they've ever heard of, they're thinking of a religious figure, some saint, some very pious man, or, you know, Saint Benedict, or someone who performed miracles, especially if you're a Catholic in the Catholic Church, you believe in all these different saints who perform these various miracles. I'm thinking less of religious context and more of just, and not even morality, more of somebody whose life and the things that they were able to accomplish was extraordinary. But not only that, the things that happened to them or didn't happen to them are extraordinary. And so there's no right or wrong answer to this question, because this is all a personal matter. You know, who is the most extraordinary person you have ever heard of, as opposed to who is the most extraordinary person who ever lived? I mean, you could debate this issue forever. There is no right or wrong answer. This is merely an issue. It's like saying what your favorite movie is, as opposed to saying, what is the best movie? What's the most amazing film you've ever watched, as opposed to what is the best film? What is the most rewatchable film? See, this is where we have to really be precise with what we're talking about. Now, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most extraordinary people I've ever heard of was a man named William Marshall, who lived at the time of Richard the Lionheart, King John the First of Robin Hood fame, the first Earl of Pembroke, and the champion of the Magna Carta. And what's extraordinary, one of the extraordinary things about this man, I'll be doing numerous podcasts on him, and I'll explain why in a second. What's extraordinary is how incredible his life is and how little well-known he is today. Most people have never heard of him, let alone know what he was, who he was, what he accomplished. And he's also remembered, if at all, in English history. And the irony of that is that he was not English, and I don't believe he even spoke English. And we're not talking about modern English. It wasn't that he was speaking old English. He just didn't speak English because he wasn't, in fact, English. William Marshall was Norman, and he lived at a very unique time in European and English history when the Normans ruled England, Normandy, and parts of France. And there is this book that really is the basis for my podcast that I'm doing on this, but you can also read this stuff online. There are so many life lessons to extract from this man's life. The biography I read, it's called The Greatest Knight, The Life of William Marshall. It's one of the most easily readable biographies I've ever read. And what's more, I was constantly underlining passages that this author was writing about either William Marshall or people that lived at the time of his lifetime that he had contact with. And there were so many things that you could learn from this man's life. Life lessons that really reveal truths. And the first one we're going to get into for this podcast is going to be how great men, extraordinary men, are the result of a combination of good fortune, good luck, and competence. And this really is going to shatter some perceptions people have of the world. I mean, I was watching a show where a person said, you know, everything that happens to you is a result of your choices. This is a very, I'd say, control freak mindset. The people who say everything that happens to you is your fault, that is an extreme fringe side of how reality works, where they perceive everything to be the result of, you know, what you will it to be, and your will makes reality what it is. And if you want things to change, you will it to be so, and everything you will to be will happen. And it's just the result of your lack of will if things don't happen. And everything that happens to you is a result of your choices and nobody else's choices, because your environment is shaped by you. I think we all can agree that that's an inaccurate and flawed perception. But on the other hand, you have people who believe that everything is either the result of luck or fortune or fate. We use these words together because we can argue and nitpick at what they actually mean. But it's essentially saying that things that happen to you that are beyond your control, you know, whether it's intentional, designed by providence, whatever you want to call it, these are things that happen to you rather than you making it happen. And of course, there's the argument to be made in a lot of cases with a lot of great men in history that much of their success was due to good fortune. I mean, take General McClellan from the American Civil War. This was a man who doesn't really today have much of a reputation the same way General Grant did, or General Sherman. And yet when Robert E. Lee was asked after the Civil War which general he thought was the best, to many people's surprise, he didn't say Grant. He said, without any hesitation, that it was McClellan. And yet McClellan had, like many Union generals, bad luck. Because it wasn't just about strategy, it was also about weather. And an example of that is where in Virginia, which he tried to invade numerous times, during the spring rain, the mud in that region would get so deep that you couldn't move an army, and an entire invasion would flounder. And yet when Sherman tries to invade the South through the same route, it doesn't rain. And that is what makes the difference between his campaign succeeding in penetrating the South as opposed to McClellan. If the rain hadn't occurred, McClellan very well could have won a campaign. So this is an example of where fortune, good luck, providence, fate comes into play and affects a man's life. Another example of this is, in a very macabre way, is Benedict Arnold, you know, the famous traitor in American history. Benedict Arnold was shot and wounded at the Battle of Saratoga. And I was reading the book on this battle, and the author noted, ironically, that had Benedict Arnold died at that battle, he would have gone down in history as one of America's greatest generals, greatest patriots. Instead, he lived, fate, fortune, whatever have you, he goes on to live and become our most notorious traitor. you know, some rifleman somewhere decided to aim differently and shoot him in the leg or the arm or wherever he was shot instead of the head or the heart or the lungs, somewhere that would have killed him. So what William Marshall's life shows us is that great men and extraordinary men are the product of good fortune and competence. So we're going to go a little bit into why that is. So we're going to start out, it actually begins as early as his childhood. So William Marshall was born in 1146 or 1147, we're not quite sure. His father was John Marshall, who was a nobleman. And at this time, King Stephen had assumed the throne in 1135. And then he later, John Marshall, decided to support the Empress Matilda when there was a civil war, which is known as the Anarchy. And at this point, John Marshall had there was a castle, Newbury Castle, that was under siege eventually in 1152. John Marshall was inside the castle. And it's important to note that William was the second born, or he was not the firstborn child of John Marshall. This is in medieval times, this was very important. That was back when the firstborn inherited everything. So from birth, William, the presumption was that he would inherit nothing. But he was also not as important as the firstborn child. Firstborn son, I should say. So there's a siege, and John, his father, gives William up to King Stephen as a pledge that he would surrender the castle. But during the negotiation, it was all a ruse. John was just using that to bide his time and wait for Matilda, Empress Matilda's forces to come and relieve him. And King Stephen demanded that John surrender the castle or else he would have William killed. And John is alleged to have replied that were William to die, he had the hammer and anvil to forge more sons. In other words, he's not my firstborn child and I can make more. And the author of the biography I read, The Greatest Knight, goes into a little bit of detail describing, you know, what is the context of a man saying that in the medieval time when infant mortality was really high? I mean, most people would have at least one, if not two, children die either at birth or when they were young. You know, there's this misconception that people lived to be 40 and that was about the lifetime span. You know, you would die when you were 40. This is a misconception because it's based off of this inaccurate reading of the median age of many people because there was such high infant mortality. If you live past a certain age, you were probably going to live into your 60s and 70s, which is exactly what happened with William Marshall. He lived to be in his 70s. And the author concludes that despite the high infant mortality and just the ever eternal presence of death in medieval society, this was a pretty callous and just cruel thing for his father to say. This would have probably shocked a lot of the people around John. And King Stephen, it's important to note, was known prior to this for his leniency with rebels, meaning there had been a rebellion before, he had put it down, and then he had pretty much pardoned the rebels and given them a slap on the wrist, which they interpreted at the time as weakness. And I think that King Stephen probably sensed, this is purely speculation on my part, but he sensed that he was being perceived as weak. And John was calling him out on it. So King Stephen decides that he's going to have William killed. And what happens is, one could argue that is the result of William's choices, but we have to remember that this was probably a six-year-old. I'm not quite sure what his age was at the time. I think he was probably 5 years old, if not younger. But each time King Stefan orders to have him killed, he relents. And they're for very interesting reasons. The first one is when they were going to have William beheaded, and he is standing next to the axeman or whoever, whatever, whoever it was that was going to actually behead him. And he was interested in seeing the man's weapon. He was asking about it. You know, being very precocious for a 5-year-old. And then the second time, William is going to be tossed in a catapult. They're going to put him in a catapult and launch him into the castle, which is, of course, going to kill him. And his body's going to be, you know, sprawled across the castle courtyard. And it's going to be demoralizing and just a horrific and gruesome death. When they bring young William out, he sees the catapult and thinks it's a toy, and he jumps into it and starts playing in it. And I think, again, purely speculative, but I think you all won't argue with me on this. King Stefan looks at this young 5-year-old and he sees him being completely innocent. Like, this is a 5-year-old who's not aware of what's going on. He has nothing involved with his father's schemes. He's completely oblivious to the fact that he's about to die a horrific death. And it dawns on King Stefan that he's about to slaughter or kill a young boy who's done nothing wrong because of what his father's done. And so there are other instances, I believe, where each time William does something that conveys this sense of innocence, that, again, another child might have done things differently and not evoked those emotions in King Stefan. Now, one could argue that, again, his behavior is what saved him, but this is presuming that he did this thing intentionally, that he planned this, that he was deliberately engaging in this behavior to get the king to not have him killed. This is where one I would argue that this is fortune. This is good fortune, because the king didn't have to have that. The king didn't have to relent. The king, and no one would have known that. So William Marshall's life could have very well ended at age 5. This great knight who was the champion of the Magna Carta, who was the champion of the jousting tournament scene, the only person known to have unhorsed Richard Lionheart in combat, his whole life, everything that he accomplished, all the things that he did, one of the most extraordinary men in history, his life could have ended at age 5. But it didn't. And William was eventually released back into the custody of his parents. And what's fascinating about this, and this is almost a different life lesson, is that William really didn't hold it against his father when he became a man. When William grew up to be an adult and he was a knight, he actually used this story for entertainment purposes, but also just to, I guess, endear himself to people in the king's court. So he was actually known to frequently discuss this story with people when he was at King Henry II's court. So this wasn't and I think it was because he was so young, it wasn't traumatizing. This is not something that left a huge mark on his life. He didn't see anything horrific as a result of this. So for him, it probably was something he didn't even really remember very well. So another example of where good fortune favored him, there's going to be two other examples that we're going to get into in this podcast. The second one is when he became a knight. So we have to remember that William was not the firstborn son. He was never going to inherit the family estate. So he had to make his own way in the world. So he became a knight after training and going through all the different instruction, which was rather extensive. He ended up becoming a knight for a certain nobleman, and there was a skirmish or battle that he was involved in which his benefactor was killed. William was severely wounded, and he was captured by the enemy. And he was wounded at the point where he was easily, he could have died of an infection. I mean, most men would have died from an infection. You know, he had to constantly replace his bandages and dress the wound in a way that wasn't going to get it infected. And his the men who had captured him really weren't interested because he had nothing. I mean, we got to remember, if you were a nobleman or you were of noble birth, you could be ransomed, but he had nothing and he wasn't the firstborn son. So his father wasn't going to do anything as far as paying his ransom. He was of little value to his captives or captors. And then what happens here is very fascinating and just, it's almost fortuitous or providential. The captors take him to a nobleman's house where a woman there sees Marshall and she gives him a loaf of bread. And when they leave the estate, William opens the piece of the loaf of bread and discovers that she had hidden several fine linen cloths that I think had been with certain like medicinal herbs and stuff like that, that he could use to dress the wound. So he was able to essentially survive what easily could have killed him. And I would argue that that is what saved him. Because infections were so easy, because they didn't have any modern medicine. There was no way to, and they didn't also understand these things as well as we do today. So I think most people who read the story and understand his condition at the time, like, he easily could have died anyways, but I'd say that those linen cloths are easily what saved him. So this is an example, again, where Marshall could have died an obscure night that nobody would ever know, but a noble lady took pity on him or liked him and decided to give him linen cloths and a loaf of bread. And of course, let's add to the competence thing. William Marshall had to be in extraordinary physical condition. I don't remember the exact nature of his wounds. I just know it was severe. And the author was noting that for him to survive and not succumb to the wounds is really a testament to his physical prowess. So this is again where fortune comes into play, or fate. Okay, great. So William has survived his wounds. He's still a captive who really has little chance of being ransomed because he's a nobody. Enter Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is now the wife of Henry II, who is the reigning king of Normandy, England, and Aquitaine, which is a section of France. Eleanor of Aquitaine had one of the greatest estates in Europe. I mean, she was considered to be one of the most, I don't want to say eligible, I don't want to use the word bachelor, but the fact that the person she married would inherit all this stuff was extraordinary. So when she marries Henry II, it is a massive transfer of land ownership to his empire or kingdom. Eleanor of Aquitaine hears about William Marshall and how he stood his ground in battle to protect his benefactor basically until the benefactor died. She hears about it and she becomes fond of him, even though she's never met him, and she pays his ransom. And then she has him brought in to be one of her knights. So, in one single act, William is made a knight to the one of the most important women in Europe. And once more, I'll keep contextualizing this. We have to keep in mind that, yes, it was good fortune, but William Marshall's competence and loyalty, and this is going to be something that we'll talk about in another episode, about that made William Marshall so extraordinary, was his loyalty. This was a man who, if there was a patron saint of fidelity, you know, Semper Fi, the Marines, always faithful. Like, if there was somebody who embodied Semper Fi, it would be William Marshall. If there was a patron saint of fidelity, it would be William Marshall. So one could argue, on the flip side, that William Marshall's conduct once more saved him. Or not saved him, but helped him advance in rank. But this is where I would point out that that's the point, is that without Eleanor of Aquitaine, he's still a captive. It's like there's different ingredients for something to happen. You know, it's like in a car, you need air, gas, and a spark. If you don't have a spark, then it doesn't work. If you don't have air, it doesn't work. If you don't have fuel, it doesn't work. You know, the combustion engine requires three ingredients for it to run. You know, pointing out that you need fuel doesn't mean you don't need air. It doesn't mean you don't need a spark either. So saying that William, in many ways, his conduct contributed to the outcomes in his life, even at an early age, we're talking at age 5, that doesn't negate the fact that other people in the situation could have made different life choices. You know, King Stephen could have been in a foul mood. He could have been in a vindictive mood. Just whatever it is, he could have been ordered to do it. We can sit here and nitpick at these situations, but ultimately these people were independent human beings with their own moral agency, and they made choices. You know, without Eleanor of Aquitaine, if you had some other queen who just really didn't care, William Marshall's life would have been completely different. And I think that this is the, you know, it reminds me of that. It's a completely apocryphal story, but I think it conveys this. You know, Napoleon, when his generals are, or his advisors are, you know, wanting a general to be promoted or promote someone to general, and they're sitting there talking about all of his qualities and his attributes. And Napoleon goes, yes, yes, yes. I know he's good. I know he's brilliant, but is he lucky? You know, the factor of having fortune favor you. It's almost as if there's something that's beyond our control, but people just have it, you know? Like someone who's considered to have bad, like, you know, the sailor superstition of the Jonah, the someone who always brings bad luck on a boat. You know, that line from Master and Commander Far Side of the World where Jack Aubrey tells his friend the doctor, you know, not everything is in your book, Stephen. This idea that there are things that we can't understand and we can't explain, but we know they're there. You know, some people where things just happen in a way that benefits them more often than not. But as we'll get into in other episodes, William Marshall wasn't just lucky. He wasn't just fortunate. He was a man like Howard Hughes, in the sense that Howard Hughes inherited a family fortune. His father developed a drill bit that made tons of money, and Howard Hughes could have easily just sat there and enjoyed it and been a trust fund baby. Instead, Howard Hughes decided to invent new airplanes, the fastest airplanes ever built. He flew them, he made movies, he did all these other very interesting things. He accomplished a lot in his lifetime because he was both fortunate and competent. And it seems like that's the key to the making of an extraordinary man. He can't just be lucky, and he can't just be competent. Not everything that happens to you is a result of your choices, but not everything that happens to you is the result of luck. And when you're given good fortune, you make you make the best of it, which is exactly what William Marshall does. But that is a topic for another podcast episode. So I hope you enjoyed listening to this. I'll be doing, like I said, others. And they're really going to be focusing on life lessons. They're not going to be focusing on the chronology. I'm not going to be doing something like, this isn't going to be a history podcast. This is more just going to be looking at the philosophical stuff in his life. So I hope you enjoyed listening to it. You can listen to other episodes of my regular podcast at tjmartinell.com. Thanks for listening.